The Capital Ideas podcast now has a new monthly edition hosted by Capital Group CEO Mike Gitlin. Investment professionals reveal their best mentors, how they find their next great idea, and a few funny stories. Subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. American Funds Distributors, Inc.
From the opinion pages of the Wall Street Journal, this is Potomac Watch.
Donald Trump takes action to ease the economic pain in the farm belt from his tariffs and declining incomes and due to low commodity prices and flooding. As a trade war with China escalates, plus Trump gives Attorney General Bill Barr the power to declassify documents related to the FBI probe of the Trump campaign in 2016. Welcome. I'm Paul Gigot, here from the Wall Street Journal with my colleagues Alicia Finley. Hello, Alicia.
Hi, Paul.
And Dan Henninger.
Hi, Dan. Paul.
Hey. Let's talk about the farm bill. Donald Trump following through, Alicia, on what he said he would do, which is to write checks, taxpayer checks financed by thee and me, to ease the financial pain of the tariffs on farmers. He has, of course, he did that last year before the election to the tune of $11 billion. Now he's talking about $16 billion. And that is something that the farmers are welcoming, but they're still not thrilled about it because most of them say, we prefer actually having markets and sales than welfare.
That's right. It's really hit the farmers hard who were already dealing with weather, drought in some cases, and flooding this year. For the last several years, farm income has been down. I think last year, Nebraska ranked 49th in the country. Kansas, Missouri weren't doing much better. And so the handouts or the direct purchase of crops last year helped mitigate the pain the farmers suffered, but did not alleviate it entirely. And what they're really issue is farm exports, most of them soy, grains, go to China. China has now imposed tariffs on 90% of U.S. exports. And as a result, the farm income is down by 50%.
It's an amazing plunge, for example, in soybean exports to China just last year. I mean, an enormous plunge. And the gap is being filled by Brazil. And
which has like faces about 3% tariff.
And now the United States soybeans, 28%.
So some of it goes to Europe, but there are still complications in the supply chains and some buildup, and it's really reduced the price that they can sell it at.
Politically, Dan, this is a big danger for the president of the United States, it seems to me. I mean, those states, he won them all, all the farm states. The one that's probably the most vulnerable to going to a Democrat in 2020 being Iowa, which he won comfortably in 2016. But it's the first time a Republican has carried Iowa in some time in a presidential race. It's not guaranteed he'll do it again.
No, not at all. I mean, it's, you know, the China trade deal is a reflection of the Trump negotiating strategy, the art of the deal. And it is also a reflection of the fact that Mr. Trump, the president, really personally believes strongly in the power of economic tariffs. Trump, yeah, if you put it to him, his favorite president is not necessarily Abraham Lincoln. It's William McKinley. And he cites the Republican tariffs of the 1880s and 1890s as one of the high points of American economic policy. And the problem there is that tariffs are indeed a weapon, but that the other side has got the ability to impose tariffs of its own. And honestly, I'm not sure the president thought through past the point, because when he began this, the last time he used these funds from this agricultural department fund to help out the farmers, he admitted there's going to be some pain, but it's going to be all right in the end. And here we are virtually a year later, and it's not all right. The tariffs are still on. The farmers are losing these markets. By and large, they probably do support the president politically, but they're losing markets, and they're suffering. And some of these farm states are going to be a close thing for the president, especially states like Wisconsin, where I think you've pointed out in previous editorials, you've got a lot of ginseng farmers who, believe it or not, export to China, and they're hurting. And that was a state Trump really did need to carry. And so the tariffs, we'll see. I mean, the trade deal is moribund. It's kind of dormant at the moment. Both sides are in a standoff position. It's not clear what the path forward is. And the longer this goes on and the longer the farmers suffer these losses that Alicia was just describing, the president runs the risk of his political support eroding across the farm states.
And to your point that the trade brawl between China and the U.S. Is showing no signs of being resolved, it's actually the rhetoric is actually escalating on both sides, and some actions are escalating on both sides. This late last week, you had the White House decide or the administration decide that it is going to bar to Huawei, the Chinese telecom company that is a national champion in telecom, bar sales from U.S. Firms to Huawei, which would do it significant harm since it buys, what, about $10 billion a year of modem chips from Qualcomm, for example. It gets inputs from Google, among others. There's a 90-day, I guess, reprieve that they've issued on this. But if that goes through, it's really a big escalation. And the Chinese have noticed, and Xi Jinping now is talking about the long march that we have to make on the trade war, which is, of course, rhetoric hearkening back to the march to Yemen in the 1930s of Communist Party lore. And he's also, I think he made an ostentatious tour of a rare earths site. These are the raw materials that China has, if not a monopoly on, a significant share of the market. And the implication being, you want to play with Huawei? We'll play with rare earths.
Right. And you think it's kind of ironic because last time when China tried to squeeze the rare earth minerals market in 2010, 2011 to hurt Japan and other supposed adversaries, American manufacturers, at least GM, some actually sought alternatives and started to develop technologies to make themselves less reliant on the Chinese. And I think you're going to see that exact same thing happen now with Huawei, ZTE, other Chinese telecom firms to try to develop their semiconductor business or maybe an operating system to compete with Android, and which would ultimately hurt U.S. businesses.
And the larger danger is it's not just the farm economy. It's could be that if you continue to see these trade tensions, and there's no resolution in sight, it could have an impact on corporate investment. And it is already having, anecdotally, the uncertainty from trade policy having an impact on corporate investment in the United States. That would affect growth. That would affect GDP. Ultimately, it could lead to a lower level of growth. One economist I know, Larry Lindsay, says he's cut his growth forecast for this year to 2.5% from 3. Others have it even lower. So the costs of this are not free for Donald Trump.
No, not at all. And having said that, Trump was dealt a tough hand. He has said so, and he's right on China. This is something, a can that has been kicked down the road both by two or three previous presidents and the business community, which was really, doing very well in trade with China. But it was these problems of China stealing intellectual property, refusing to open its markets, forcing companies to take in Chinese partners. It's been apparent for a long time.
And then turn over technology.
And turning over technology. So there had a kind of consensus had developed that we did have to confront the Chinese on these issues. Now, on the Chinese side, they're split between the reformers, the hardliners, most of the hardliners being the Communist Party officials who benefited from the status quo. But the reformers, like Liu He, their primary trade negotiator, understood that if the Chinese economy was going to continue to grow, it did need to make some of these structural changes. All this is by way of saying the deal that the United States was proposing to China had some attractive features on the Chinese side. The question is whether Trump has overplayed his hand. And by insisting on these tariffs, he pushed the Chinese into a position where they felt they just couldn't accept the deal. I mean, there's an idea, notion in trading known as the Chinese exit, where if you've really got your negotiating partner cornered, you got to give them a way out of the corner. And I don't know whether Donald Trump's art of the deal includes letting people out of a corner, or whether it just means you throw up your hands and say, I give up. That China is a big country, and they're not going to throw up their hands and say, we give up.
We're talking about the politics and economics of the U.S.-China trade spat, and you're listening to Potomac Watch from The Wall Street Journal.
The Capital Ideas podcast now has a new monthly edition hosted by Capital Group CEO Mike Gitlin. Investment professionals reveal their best mentors, how they find their next great idea, and a few funny stories. Subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. American Funds Distributors, Inc.
From the opinion pages of The Wall Street Journal, this is Potomac Watch.
Welcome back. I'm Paul Gigot with Alicia Finley and Dan Henninger, and we're talking about the China trade dispute. And Dan makes a point about Donald Trump finally tackling this issue of Chinese cheating, and I think there's bipartisan support in the United States for Trump taking a tough position. But and I think there's a lot of support in the business community and the labor community for that as well. But to a certain extent, their argument is, hey, thanks, Donald. You go ahead and lead with your chin. And if there's any economic fallout, we'll blame you for that because we'll say you didn't get the deal. So in a way, the Joe Bidens get it both ways, right? They can criticize him for his trade strategy. And yet, good for him for taking on the Chinese. But then if he doesn't get a deal, they say, see, it's all his fault. He's supposed to be the art of the deal man. He doesn't get it. So there is some significant downside here. I guess, you know, from the president's point of view, I think all of us have had experience of talking to senior administration officials, and we know that Donald Trump is not averse to saying, okay, if I don't get a deal, I'm going to run as a trade hawk on China. And he might be willing to do that, particularly against Joe Biden, Alicia.
Well, I think that's right. And it's very similar to his position on immigration. He thinks this plays to his advantage. I think it's interesting you mentioned that Democrats, are eager to let him take it on the chin, and you see Chuck Schumer really urging him or egging him on.
Jump off the cliff, Mr. President.
Right. And actually, I don't think they will be satisfied. Even if Trump does get a deal, they will still criticize and say it doesn't go far enough. It's probably particularly on labor standards and environmental standards, those kinds of things, just like they have with the USMCA, the new NAFTA agreement that but actually, the most important issues here probably are intellectual property, and you probably won't see too much pushback on that.
Well, and the Chinese have something to answer for here, too, as Dan suggested. They have interests in their country that don't want to reform and feel like they've been benefiting from this. And they also want to take on the United States in a more systematic fashion. So I'm really not sure how this is going to turn out. Whereas 3 or 4 months ago, I would have said, the incentives for both sides to do a deal are enormous. But now I'm beginning to wonder if, in fact, these folks might say, maybe for fighting here, from the president's point of view, maybe the tariffs are a better issue to run on than the economy. I don't agree with that, but maybe he thinks it. And then from the Chinese side, we'll just wait Donald Trump out for 18 months and we'd much rather deal with Joe Biden.
Well, running as a trade hawk might make sense if you could assume that the economy was going to sustain itself at this level for the next year and a half through to the election. Paul, that's a long time for an economy to start to roll downhill if it's suffering the effects of a trade standoff with China. And as you suggested, it's beginning to have some effects at the margin on investment. I was talking to a big investor just the other night who said a lot of his companies are rethinking their supply chains on these things. And if the economy erodes, you can run as a trade hawk, but boy, that will give the Democratic nominee a big advantage going into 2020.
All right, lots to look forward to as the weeks go on here in this continuing debate. Let's move to before we go to another decision this week by the president, which was to issue a statement explaining that he has now made a decision, giving to the Attorney General of the United States, at the Attorney General's request, the authority to and he's declassified documents and given to the AG the authority to release those that he wants to release to the public concerning the counterintelligence probe of the by the FBI and the intelligence services of the Trump campaign. In 2016, this includes FISA court surveillance, foreign intelligence surveillance court, as well as the warrants against Carter Page and any other Trump officials. What's the importance of this, Dan?
I think the importance, I think it can hardly be overstated, quite frankly. And I believe today as well, the president ordered the intelligence agencies to cooperate with Attorney General Barr's investigation. I go back to that famous appearance of Mr. Barr's before the Senate, in which he said, I think there was spying on a presidential candidate, by which he certainly meant spying, but also surveillance. Bill Barr has been around Washington a long time. He served in the CIA, previously in the Justice Department. And I think Mr. Barr believes strongly in that what the country needs is institutional integrity, whether it's the Justice Department or the CIA. And as after he took this job, it became clear to him something had gone off the rails in 2016 on this point. And that he's determined to find out what did go wrong with the CIA and the FBI, why we ended up in a situation where you had these intelligence agencies investigating a candidate for the presidency of the United States without telling him. And I believe the American people at this point, at least half of the population, is itself concerned about that. I think there's been a loss of faith in some of these institutions, and that Attorney General Barr understands. If the U.S. is to function, it needs a public that trusts its intelligence agencies to do the kinds of work they need. I mean, by definition, you entrust a lot to them that you don't know about. And I think that's the contract that Mr. Barr is trying to reestablish with this investigation.
By giving the authority to the Attorney General, it also takes it out of the hands of Dan Coats, the Director of National Intelligence, who has to coordinate the intelligence services and is and obviously under could be under enormous pressure to listen to them as they have decided, as they say, no, you can't do any of that. Whereas Barr can say, well, look, I actually think that we need to release these documents for the following reasons. Also takes the pressure a little bit off of Mr. Wray, Christopher Wray, the head of the FBI, and Gina Haspel, the head of the CIA, because they'll now be able to say, honestly, it's out of my hands. It's not a decision that I can make. And Barr is the person running this show. So I'll make my case, but it's out of their hands and in his.
Right. I mean, he's taking a lot of political heat. And I think President Trump is glad that he's doing this. He was very critical, perhaps gratuitously so, of Jeff Sessions for not declassifying, even though the Justice Department had objections to certain things that they needed to be or should be declassified. But I think Barr is really becoming a villain on the left, but he's also becoming a hero on the right for making these tough decisions.
He's not going to, I mean, if you ask, I guess Barr could say, well, now I'm going to take the heat for all this, but he would hardly take any more. I mean, he's been vilified in what the 6 weeks he's had the job almost to the extent of anybody else in this administration. And so, what else does he have to lose?
Yeah, I mean, there was this phenomenon that emerged that came to be known as Trump derangement syndrome. We pretty clearly now have Barr derangement syndrome because there are a lot of people on the left just have kind of lost it over Bill Barr. But, you know, I think they understand there's something serious at stake, that there was an effort originating in the Obama administration somewhere to surveil the Trump candidacy. And I think, by and large, there was people snapped. They had the feeling in 2016 that somebody unfit to be president of the United States was indeed about to become president of the United States and that they had to do something about it. These were really wrong decisions that a lot of people made in this respect. And it's now Bill Barr's unfortunate and unhappy task to reveal to the American people what went on.
And just should point out that we have other things percolating here. There's the report of the Inspector General at the Justice Department on some of these similar matters. There's another prosecutor, John Huber out of Utah, who's been looking into the some of the handling of the Hillary Clinton emails. You also so that's going along as well. And the Attorney General just named John Durham, an attorney out of Connecticut, to look into some of these things too. So you can tell there's a degree of anxiety here by some of these intelligence officials just by the way and so vociferously they are speaking up against this. James Comey has hit the airwaves to do this. John Brennan has done the same, the former director of the CIA. This is going to have some fireworks, I think, within the next 6 to 9 months.
Yeah, I think it's probably going to be, frankly, I think it's going to be as big as the Mueller report when this stuff starts coming out, because a lot of rocks are going to be turned over, and we're going to find, I think, some very famous names under those rocks. And it's going to be kind of interesting to see how the American media deals with it, because they loaded up on the collusion narrative for 18 months, and that didn't work out. And I think what Barr is actually going to discover is why there was no there in terms of the collusion narrative.
All right. Thank you, Dan. Thank you, Alicia. Thank you all for listening. We'll be back next week after Memorial Day with more editions of Potomac Watch. Please enjoy the holiday.
This message comes from Viking, committed to exploring the world in comfort. Journey through the heart of Europe on an elegant Viking longship with thoughtful service, destination-focused dining, and cultural enrichment on board and on shore. And every Viking voyage is all-inclusive with no children and no casinos. Discover more at Viking.com.